Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will join the conversation in a few minutes to answer your questions. But we're going to start the hour with bugs. Donald Lewis is a professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Hello, Donald.
Hello.
Hi. Now I can hear you.
Now I'm here. Okay, good.
Wonderful to hear your voice. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Glad to do it.
Now, of course, recent rains have been devastating for some people, but good for others. And there are some species of insects that have really liked the recent rains. We've had a few real population booms, haven't we?
Well, it seems like it. And it kind of depends on where you are and maybe how much you notice them. But two especially that thrive in damp conditions. And it doesn't have to be heavy rain. It doesn't need to be the 3 to 10 inches of rain. It just needs to be constantly moist for earwigs and springtails to blossom and do well.
All right. And they're kind of weird little insects. So let's talk about earwigs. I know earwigs in particular kind of freak people out.
Well, yes, they do. And it's probably a combination of things. It might be related to the old superstition that they lay eggs in your ears, which of course is just a superstition, no fact to that at all. But they also have a bit of an annoying habit of showing up inside the house unexpectedly. And when they do, they run fairly fast and they hold their tail up in the air and they wiggle back and forth. And then they have these elongated pinchers on the tail end of the body. And all of those things just add up to a pretty high creepiness factor.
Right. Okay, so should we be creeped out by earwigs?
Oh, probably not. We're talking about something that is an outdoor insect. It's not a household pest. It would be hard to raise them inside because you need that constantly moist environment. It doesn't have to be running water. It doesn't have to be wet. It just needs to be really humid. And if you imagine what it's like between the mulch and the soil, that would be a place where earwigs would do very, very well. So they're going to be in that area. They are omnivores like us. They will eat other insects if they're available. They will eat the foliage and flowers off your plants when that's available to them. So they do have kind of this mixed message. They can be beneficial if they're eating other insects, but when they're eating the blossoms off your petunias, okay, now they've crossed the line and they're over into the pest. But they're harmless to people. They can't bite. They don't sting. They don't lay eggs in your ears. So we should be able to coexist, but boy, are they annoying when they exist in large numbers under your potted plants, around your patio, and especially when they're crawling inside the house.
And they do seem to like to come inside the house. What are they looking for? Why?
Well, you know, I don't think they're looking for anything. I think the goal of earwigs and other insects is that there's a gap or a crack. It could have been the gap between the foundation and the siding. It could have been the gap under the door. And they just crawl in there to hide. But that gap keeps going. And so they keep going and they get into the house by accident. I don't think they're searching for anything. In fact, getting into the house is a disadvantage to earwigs because it's too dry for them to thrive. So it wasn't to their advantage to crawl into the house. But I think in exploring cracks and gaps, especially at night when they are most active, they crawl into a gap. And if that gap keeps going, now they're indoors.
All right. And let's talk about those scary looking pinchers one more time. Is there anything that I could do to an earwig that would make it hurt me?
I don't think so. The earwigs use their pinchers for defense. Oddly enough, if you're really curious, you can tell the difference between the males and the females simply by looking at the pincher. The males are the ones with the curved pinchers, and the females are the ones with the straight pinchers. And those appear to be defensive as much as anything. So I suppose you could annoy an earwig to the point that they would try to pinch you, but I don't think it's going to be very effective. I don't think it's going to be it's not going to be a blood-drawing pinch if you could get them to pinch you.
All right. Now, let's say you have earwigs in your house. Obviously, a lot of people don't want them in there. What's the best way to remove them?
Well, once they're inside, you could wait for them to die of dehydration, or you could vacuum them up or sweep them up or just pick them up and throw them back outside. I think the mechanical removal, the hand removal, is the practical solution for those that are inside, because they're not going to survive for long, and they're not attracted to a particular habitat where we could apply an insecticide indoors. So spraying indoors is not a good solution. Mechanical control, sweep or vacuum them up and discard them.
All right. And they're not going to breed inside and create a long-term infestation, are they?
Under the right conditions, you could probably raise them. But now we're talking about another problem. If you've got a moisture problem that is suitable for earwigs, you've also got wood decay, you've got fungus, you've got mold, you've got something else going on because you have too much moisture that's accumulating in a place. So under normal circumstances, no, they would not reproduce indoors, but they do reproduce slowly outdoors in those moist environments.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about springtails then, another weird little insect. Tell us about springtails.
Oh, springtails are wonderful. They are recyclers. They are feeding on decaying organic matter, again, in damp locations, such as under the mulch, under the leaf litter, in the cracks of the soil. So they are nature's recyclers. They are feeding on the decaying organic matter and recycling those nutrients. So in a healthy soil, we may find thousands to millions of springtails doing what they do, helping to keep the soil ecosystem going. But they're also an accidental invader. The name springtail describes how they get around. They have a tail, a forked tail on the end of the abdomen that they fold forward up under their abdomen, and they lock that forked tail in place under tension. And when they need to move quickly, they release that tail and it slaps downward, hits the ground, and they spring up into the air. It looks like they're hopping, but it's actually this motion of the tail slapping the surface and propelling them upward. Now, this sounds like it's pretty complicated, but remember, we're talking about something that's roughly an eighth to 3/16 of an inch long. So they're very small. They're very tiny, unlike the earwigs, which were half an inch. Very easy to see. Springtails are very small, but live in sort of the same locations and thrive where there's a lot of moisture and dampness and that decaying organic matter to feed on.
All right. And again, they sometimes make their way indoors, right?
Yes. And this is a little more annoying than even the earwigs, in my opinion, because they're so small, they can come in through very small cracks under the door, the sliding glass door, the basement walkout, wherever it is that is next to their environment, they can walk in and annoy you inside. Again, because our houses are so dry under most circumstances, they're not going to reproduce, they're not going to live for long, but you do find them crawling across the floor kind of at random, and that can be annoying and disturbing.
Or delightful if you're a cat.
Cats apparently like to play with these things.
We've seen a lot of that in our household over the last few days, actually.
Control by cat. I love
right,
it.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So, again, if you want to try to get them out of your house?
Well, try to prevent them as much as you can. With both earwigs and springtails, they're outdoor insects that have wandered in by mistake. So what can we do to keep them outside? And one of those things would be fewer cracks and crevices for them to get in. And we know that in spite of our best efforts at weatherproofing, our best efforts at constructing energy-tight houses, there are cracks and gaps where these insects can get in, either around the windows, around the doors, between the foundation and the siding, or someplace. Spraying outside is going to be a very little benefit for either one. That insecticide in a damp location won't last long. And it's not going to be spraying the top of the mulch. If you're going to try to reduce the population, you'll have to rake the mulch back, spray the soil surface, and then put the mulch back under the plants. So now we're talking a lot of work for just a very little benefit. But using our perimeter insecticides across thresholds, around window frames, maybe the gap between the foundation and siding, there might be some benefit to spraying those kinds of cracks and gaps with a residual insecticide made for house use. Again, spraying indoors is not going to be very effective at all.
All right. And they are beneficial insects outside, right?
Yes. Outside, both of these have a benefit. Both of them have a beneficial ecological role. And if you're looking for one more reason to tolerate, if not actually love, earwigs, they are good mothers. Earwigs, unlike most insects, actually take care of their offspring. They lay their eggs in a clutch in a small depression, and then they care for the eggs by rotating them and by cleaning them from of mold. And when the eggs hatch into little tiny nymphs, the female feeds her offspring and protects them by guarding them from other earwigs and other predators. So they make good mothers, and that's one more reason to try to appreciate them and enjoy them.
All right, and at least coexist with them.
Coexist if you can. Throw them back outside, those that get inside.
All right. Now, before we get to the break here, what are some of the other insect populations we've seen really jump up with recent rains?
You know, we would expect more mosquitoes than we have seen. And yes, the mosquito population is a little more annoying for my garden work than I would like. But compared to bad mosquito years, it's not bad yet. We've had plenty of rainfall. We've had so much rain, in fact, that the mosquitoes have not had a chance to reproduce because the water isn't stagnant. The water isn't impounded and standing still. Now, there may be some places now that the rains may be over for a little bit. There may be some places that the water will impound. It'll stay there for the week to 10 days that it requires for mosquitoes to reproduce. But mosquitoes, we would expect an uptick soon, although we haven't had one through the month. We did not have the uptick through the month of June. It's time for the weevils to be invading the house, and that's not related to weather. That's just because it's July. And the strawberry root weevil and the imported longhorned weevil are two little critters that live outside in your lawn, don't cause you any problem. But in the month of July, they start crawling. They can't fly, so they crawl. And they bump into your house, and they get into your house, and these little light bulb-shaped little weevils that are less than a quarter inch long are there in your house. So that's the other one.
They are coming.
And they are coming.
All right. Well, we have to take a break right now. We'll be back in just a moment with me, Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University. You can join us with your questions. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Professor of Entomology, Donald Lewis. And joining us now, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, Richard Giron. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And we've already got a bunch of insect questions just pouring in. You can join the conversation with your questions about plants or insects, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here's a question we were expecting, Donald. This is from Bill in Carlisle. He says, I've sprayed my two Honeycrisp apple trees with fruit tree spray as per your directions. I sprayed over a month ago, and earlier this week, I found hundreds of Japanese beetles destroying the leaves. There are still beetles on the tree. What should I do next? Help.
Help, yes. Japanese beetle is a funny one in that for most of the state, it appears the population is lower this year than it was last year. And remember, in 2013, the population was very high, but in 2014, the population was low. It built through 2015, 16, and 17, and last year we had a lot of problems. This year, for most of us, it appears to be slightly less. But there are these spots. Carlisle appears to be one of them, and Iowa City region appears to be one where the populations are still high enough to cause problems. Well, Bill's problem is that the Japanese beetles don't all come at once. They dribble into the population as they emerge as adults over a long period of time, and repeated application is usually the solution. The problem with fruit trees is you're limited on how many applications of the home orchard spray, the combination products you can make. And so you may have to substitute a different product in between sprays, something like the Surround is a clay product that we can put on fruit trees to control Japanese beetles, or at least to deter them, and or switch to a different insecticide than the one that is in the fruit tree spray. There are no easy answers. Netting would work if we had really fine netting, but under large populations, it takes repeated application to keep the beetles from eating the leaves off the trees.
All right. And, okay, the beetles eat the leaves. Is that going to destroy the fruit crop?
Probably. And it depends on how much they eat and when they eat it. But the leaves are necessary to produce the sugars that go into the apple to make the apple grow. And without the leaves, the apples just sort of sit there and they don't grow and they don't ripen. Also, the leaves are important for shading the fruit from too much sunshine. So without leaves on apple trees, you can expect less yield, yes.
All right. So it's bad news all around. We've been, I've been noticing, of course, I live in the Iowa City area where there are plenty of Japanese beetles right now. They are hitting my windshield like crazy. Feels like there are just squadrons of them flying down the road all the time. But obviously they have to stop and eat a lot of leaves,
they
too.
They eat somewhere, but so you're slaughtering them with
right,
your windshield.
With my windshield.
Okay.
It feels good.
That's one control.
All right. Here's a question from Susan in Charles City. I recently moved back to Iowa and have seen many hollyhocks happily growing in other people's yards. Are hollyhocks a perennial? What are tips for getting hollyhocks to grow?
They are actually a biennial. So they form a cluster of leaves the first year, and then they grow very quickly the next year, get very tall, flower, and then produce seed. And so once you establish them, they come back from seed. So the key is to establish them and then just let them take care of themselves.
All right. So they do well in Iowa.
They do. Basically, just a well-drained, sunny location.
All right. Let's get to another insect question. The phone number is 866-780-9100. And Carol is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Carol.
Good morning. My question has to do with a flowering bush in my front yard that is it looks like a hydrangea plant, but it's not. It's some sort of white flowering bush. And we've had it for about 15 years. But this year, it is absolutely covered in what looks like the common housefly. They're there all day long. It is just thick with them. And they look to be not destroying the plant, but leaving some sort of either leaving an egg or deposit on the leaves or doing something on the leaves. But all day long, and I'm wondering if it's going to be bad for the plant or what is going on and why they're there.
We're still trying to figure out what this plant might be,
right.
And Richard's going to have that answer shortly.
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe not.
Flies in general.
It's a white flowering bush.
Okay. And it's flowering right now?
It is. It's in full bloom. It turns, the leaves turn like a rust-colored pink in the autumn. It's a very pretty flowering bush, but we've just never seen it covered in what looks like houseflies.
Right.
Flies
in general are not a pest on plants. There are some exceptions to that rule. There are flies that live inside the leaf as a leaf miner, and columbine has an example of that where you see these trails through the leaves. But otherwise, uh-huh. My guess is the flies are attracted to the nectar that's coming off of this plant, and they're there feeding and are enjoying the plant, but might not likely to hurt it unless you tell me some other symptom that would be related to fly or maggot damage.
The plant itself is how big, would you say?
Okay. Now, why just this year? We've never seen this before.
Oh, you know, every year is a little different. Let's blame the weather. How's that?
Okay.
It could be weather related, that because of the moisture in the soil, there's a few more flies around, or because of other things aren't blooming, the flies are attracted to this one. But what's the size of this flowering shrub?
It's about 4 or 5 feet tall and wide.
Okay. And when did it start blooming?
It always starts in May.
Is it?
And like I said, it blooms all through the fall, but with a rust-colored sort of pinkish bloom in the fall.
I'm thinking it might be a type of hydrangea. I say that because there are quite a few different ones on the market, different species, different varieties, and it may be some type of hydrangea. For example, there's one on campus called Quick Fire, and it blooms very early, earlier than most hydrangeas. And walking by it the other day, I noticed it did attract quite a few insects to the flowers. Quite a few. More so than normal. So I wonder if it may be a hydrangea of some type.
But it'll be okay.
Should be.
It'll be okay. I don't think the flies can hurt it, but they're loving it as much as you do right now.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Carol. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Jeff is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, on my milkweed, and this is a native milkweed plant that grows in with my wildflowers. It's a orange insect, and I see it along with the box elder bugs, but it's a larger, much larger, has a round head, orange, and a body that's mostly all orange. And they do fly, but they eat the flowers, you know, the blooms. Okay. And then when pods develop, they also bore into those. So I'm just wondering what it is.
There's a couple of different things come to mind. The milkweed bug is soft and leathery, like the box elder bug. It's generally more orange in color, and they feed on sap from the developing pods, but they have sap-feeding mouthparts. They have puncturing mouthparts, and so you wouldn't see the damage. There's also the red milkweed beetles, which are hard-shelled, usually about 5/8 to 3/4 of an inch long. They have fairly long antennae, and normally they're sort of a reddish-orange color with black spots. And the milkweed beetles, the red milkweed beetles, do feed on the flowers, not to any great detriment as far as we can tell, but that's part of the ecosystem of having milkweeds, is to have this the symphony of different kinds of insects that will be there at different times of the year.
Okay. And then one more question related to milkweed. Does the monarch lay eggs and the caterpillar feed on our natural milkweed plant, or is it only on butterfly milkweed plants, which I have a few of those also?
I think
I never see any caterpillars on the cocoons or any of that.
I've lost track. I think we have 17 different kinds of milkweeds that we can grow in Iowa, and all of them are host to the milkweed to the monarch caterpillar. So yes, there could be eggs on there. I think of the butterfly weed, the orange native one, as being a little short, and it seems like the monarchs maybe pass that one over in favor of the common milkweed. But no, you can find milkweed, you can find monarch caterpillars on all different kinds of milkweeds.
Okay, I'll keep watching for that then.
All right,
thank you so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for your call, Jeff. 866-780-9100 is the number. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's an email from Wayne. He says, I've had a good growing garden for the last 20 years, but my radishes never grow bulbs. Plenty of tops, but no nice round bulbs. I've varied when I plant, the ground type and location, more and less horse dirt. It's a nice euphemism,
manure.
More and less water, just like the package and internet says, but still only spindly, unradish-like roots. What can I do?
Well, plant in the spring early because I like the cool weather. When they come up, thin them so their space may be 2 or 3 inches apart, and do not fertilize, because if you have high nitrogen levels, you get basically all foliage and no roots. So basically no chemical fertilizer, and maybe no manure for a while.
All right. So do less.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Hopefully less work will pay off. Here's an email from Greg in Story City. We are noticing very few bees or butterflies of any sort in the flower and vegetable garden. Also, the tomato plants are healthy and growing like mad, but there are precious few fruits being set and few blossoms noted. Is this a local issue?
No, not necessarily a local issue, but it is a problem that in general, butterfly and bee populations are lower than what we've experienced in past years. But tomatoes don't require insects for pollination generally, so maybe something else is going on.
The problem is, right, the temperatures. When you have flowering on tomatoes, they're very temperature dependent. And when you have temperatures during the day that are above 90, you do not get proper pollination. You don't get that. So they flower, but they don't set fruit. So ideally, we want temperatures during the day below 90, but above 60 at night.
All right. So it's just been too
right.
hot.
It's 90s is not good.
All right. Here's a question from Sam. This year, for the first time in many years, I've had quite a few tomato hornworms devouring my tomato plants. I like the moths that these worms turn into, so I'd like to move them to another part of the yard. How far do they travel, and will they just come back to the tomato plants?
Wow, those are good questions. And it's odd to find someone who wants to preserve tomato hornworms anywhere. They're fairly host plant specific, that they're going to feed on tomatoes and its and related plants. But there's a thing called imprinting that caterpillars tend to stay with the food where they started. And so the chances of moving, say, tomato hornworm off a tomato plant and putting it onto tobacco and letting it grow, it may or may not work. And so he'll have to do a lot of experimentation.
And are those the only two options, tomato or tobacco?
You know, you might try nightshade as well, but I don't see them on potatoes, so I think it's a fairly limited host range. But the tomato hornworms come and go, and I think in general I'm seeing more and hearing more complaints about tomato hornworms in the last few years than I did over the past couple of decades, so... It does feel like there's more of them out there. It's one of those things that people remember from their childhood, and then they kind of wondered where they went, but, oh, they seem to be back. So I think they're going to come and go, and populations are going to rise and fall, but enjoy them while you've got them. I don't know that relocating them to another host plant is going to be very successful, so maybe you can create a sacrificial tomato plant and say, this is my hornworm plant.
All right, and let us know how that works.
Yeah, that's right.
Because they can defoliate one tomato plant pretty quickly.
Well, when they reach that full-grown length of about 4 inches, it looks like they're eating a leaf an hour. The leaves go very quickly when they're large. But, of course, the hornworms have been there for 2 to 4 weeks before we even notice them.
Wow.
And when they're small, they don't eat much and they don't attract a lot of attention. When they get large, then we can see them. But by then, the damage is progressing rapidly.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Jason in Bluegrass. Hi, Jason.
Hey. First, I'd like to say I think your show is fantastic, and I'm grateful you guys are on the air. Listen to it as often as I can.
Well, thanks.
I have a couple of oak trees, and they're probably about 150 years old. They're huge, and they're right next to each other. One of them I noticed early this spring, it's losing a lot of leaves on one side, and recently I checked again, and it's about a third of the tree, which is a lot of damage. And I'm not too sure if – I don't think it's oak wilt. I've looked that up, and the leaves aren't turning brown. I'm finding lots of pieces of bark on the ground, dead limbs falling down, and it's kind of becoming a hazard, and I hate to lose the trees. I know that you're not supposed to cut more than a third off, I think, at a time, and you should wait till the fall. But I'm wondering what the problem could be, how long the trees are expected to live, if it's some kind of termite damage, if it is some kind of infestation, should I try to cut the limbs down sooner and try to seal it with something? I'm not too sure which direction to go.
I think what I would try to do is maybe try to determine the cause of the leaf drop. And so what you might want to do is at the very beginning, maybe take some photos of the tree. Maybe one or two photos of the tree as a whole. And then maybe a few photos of maybe some of the affected branches or foliage, the ones that are falling to the ground.
Yeah.
And send those to the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic here at Iowa State.
Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic.
Right.
Okay.
Their email address is P as in plant, I as in insect, D as in disease, C as in clinic, at iastate.edu.
All right, Jason, thanks a lot and good luck with that problem. And don't just go cutting limbs off an oak tree in the summer, right, Richard?
Right.
Wait till fall.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with me, Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about plants and insects. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Duran and Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. They are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Joyce is on the line next in Waterloo. Hi, Joyce.
Hello. I have a patio garden and a lot of little webs, they look like spider webs, and around the webs, or on the webs, are little tiny, I guess, spiders, no bigger than the head of a pin. And how do I get rid of them? What are they? And will they eventually kill my plants?
The good news is spiders can't hurt your plants because spiders are all predators. They feed on other insects. They feed on other arthropods, including all the small insects that they can capture. So spiders are beneficial, and if that's the cause of the webs, then there really is no damage to the plant. That can be unsightly and unnerving, in which case we sometimes use a forceful stream of water to dislodge the webs and to dislodge the spiders. We could spray them with an insecticidal soap or a soapy water to try to kill them. But the thing to do is get down close enough to look and see if they have eight legs or six. And if they're on a web with eight legs, they're spiders. They're not going to hurt the plant. They're going to be beneficial to you, but you still might want to reduce the population for your own peace of mind.
Well, thank you very much. I'm relieved.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Joyce.
Sure. Thank you.
Next up, Barry in Cincinnati, Iowa. Hi, Barry.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, thank you for taking my call. I just heard part of the gentleman a little while back regarding the monarch butterflies and milkweed, and I've heard that the monarch butterflies either are endangered or soon will be endangered because of the loss of their food to milkweed. And I was wondering, if that is true, then how much milkweed would a person have to plant? How big a patch would you have to plant to start drawing the monarchs to you or to your feed, your food plot for them? I know that I don't see near the monarchs now that I did 50 years ago as a child. So, I mean, I know in my own experience I've seen a lot less of them.
Yes. Yes to all of those things. Yes, there are fewer of them. And this is documented by the World Wildlife Fund that measures the overwintering monarch population in Mexico. And it's down to 1/20th or less of what it used to be only 20 to 25 years ago. So there's been this dramatic decrease in the number of monarchs overwintering in Mexico, which we think translates into decreased populations around the upper Midwest. Yes, milkweed is their favorite host. And how much should you plant? As much as you can. We have lost most of the milkweeds from 125 million acres of corn and soybeans in the upper Midwest. And that's because of changes in agronomic practices that allow us to control milkweeds and other weeds in crops that are tolerant to glyphosate and other herbicides. So we have reduced the population of milkweeds in the upper Midwest, and that may be a portion of why we're also seeing the reduced population of monarch butterflies. So as much milkweed as you can plant, let's please do so. As much as we can get into roadsides and into fence rows and into gardens and public spaces, as much as we can get into field borders and so forth, the better off we'll be. But it's an uphill climb to try to replace milkweeds that used to be on all the corn and soybean acres of the upper Midwest.
And as monumental a task as that is, just planting milkweed in your own yard is incredibly rewarding. I mean, we have a bunch of milkweed in our yard, and the payoff has been almost instantaneous. We have quite a few monarchs back there.
It's good to have. And it's not everybody gets as good a results as Charity explained, that it just because you plant it doesn't mean they will come. So it may take some patience. It may take some time to establish it. There are lots of good sources. The one I would direct you to is Monarch Watch. MonarchWatch.org is a website that has been at this for 40 years or more of trying to encourage monarch butterflies and milkweed planting around the country. And they'll help you find milkweeds to plant, and they will help you understand the biology of the monarch.
All right, Barry, thank you so much for your call. Great question. Let's go back to email. Janine says, I have spent countless hours working outdoors during the last 17 years at our property in rural Johnson County. I have had, all told, maybe a dozen chiggers. This year, however, every time I work outside, even for an hour, I come in covered with chigger bites. Same for my husband, and my sister in Cedar Rapids is experiencing this too. What is going on? Is there anything I can use to repel them?
Well, what's going on is probably bad luck and excess moisture. Chiggers live in humid environments, so we usually don't get chiggers in our mowed lawn because that's too hot and dry for the most part. They are at the borders, they're at the edges, they're where the woods meet where the woodland meets the mowed grass. Those areas where there's tall vegetation so that the ground stays shaded and so that there's humidity there that favors the chiggers. Also, chiggers have to have another food source other than just us, and that tends to be small mammals. And so where there are more chipmunks and so forth, there could be more. But it's highly variable from year to year, from place to place. And I'm not convinced it's just chiggers when she talks about feeling the reaction immediately. Often it's a day or two later for most of us when chigger bites tend to develop. So there could be more than one thing going on, but there are no easy answers for chiggers. Spraying the lawn doesn't help. Spraying the landscape isn't going to do much of a difference. What we find is that showering when you come inside to remove chiggers that have not yet begun to feed is probably our best prevention from chigger bites.
Could you spray them off with a hose if you don't want to shower every time? Or
sure, you stand still and I'll spray you off with the hose.
Thanks, Donald. I appreciate that. Just thinking before you go inside.
Well, sure, but the question is, where are you going to spray? And chiggers more often bite at where there's confinement, where where the elastic meets your skin, where your socks fit tight against your legs, or the creases behind your knee and places like that. So you almost have to get your clothes off for the hosing off to work.
All right. Noted. Let's move on to the next question. This one's from Joan. We've never had a problem with fleas until last year when a flea infestation actually took our elderly cat's life. We believe the fleas are mostly in the yard and grass. We mow regularly, but fleas are still an issue. How can we safely control them?
Fleas are a funny story in that, again, we don't get them in the lawns here the way they do down south. Your mowed grass is probably not the source of fleas. Instead, fleas tend to survive in the nest of the raccoons that live under your porch, or they live on the skunks. They live on the other small animals that are out there. Fleas are a nest dweller. They don't stay on the animal very long. They stay on the animal only long enough to feed. Then they fall off wherever the animal nests. Cat and dog flea problems really have diminished as we have gone to the oral insecticides or the spot-on insecticides, things like Frontline and the other insecticides that we use for treating ticks and fleas on our pets. And that's the materials that you get from your veterinarian are probably going to be your best defense. Again, like chiggers and ticks, spraying the lawn is not going to do much good.
All right. So treating your pets is probably the best way to deal with that. And if they're in the house, then you have an insecticide issue.
You have an insecticide issue, although you can, when they're in the house, you can start with regular, thorough, and very frequent vacuuming. That suction of picking them up out of the carpet after they've dropped off the pet is part of that for those who want to use less insecticide in their house.
All right. I'm going to read this question because I think it's entertaining. But we have had a couple more questions about earwigs, and I will refer people back to the beginning of the show. This one was from Tony. He says, I have earwigs. How do I remove them? Every time my fiance sees one, she screams, and I'm pretty sure the neighbors hate her. So again, we have more earwigs because of the damp weather recently. This too shall pass. And you can listen later online at iowapublicradio.org to find out more about them. Here's a question from Carolyn in Cedar Rapids. I'm not seeing lightning bugs this summer. Why?
Well, some people are, some people aren't. That's kind of the gist of it. And it varies with location. I get reports that the lightning bugs have been great this year. And, of course, I always think of 4th of July as sort of the peak. I would say in my own backyard and in the golf course where I walk the dog, the population does seem so-so. It's not overabundant, but there have been a few there. They seem to have started early, which means they may end early as well. So where we normally think of them going to kind of the middle to the third week of July, we may already be down on the downhill slide, but fireflies are one of those that, again, do best in moist environments. The larvae live under the grass in the tall grass, in the fence rows and in the roadsides and so forth. We don't get a lot of firefly larvae living in our yards and in our landscapes, but I think it's just so highly variable that Carolyn's experience is like some of us. We're seeing fewer, but other people are seeing as many or more.
It's been pretty magical in my yard this year. Sorry.
Yeah.
All right. Here's a question from Jean. She says, my cherry trees have had more and more worms in the cherries over the last 3 to 4 years, both in sweet cherries and tart cherries. I've worked to clean up the ground of dropped cherries throughout the season. How do they get into the cherries? Is there an organic way to eliminate or control these worms?
It's not going to be easy, and the organic treatments tend to be so-so at best. But the worms get into the cherries because, most of the worms in cherries are fly larvae, and we will refrain from calling them maggots because they're in a food supply. So the fly larvae get there because the fly laid her eggs on the cherries. Sanitation is a good step, and we may need to know a little bit more about the size and shape of these larvae to figure out exactly which one of the possibilities it is. But insecticides at the time the cherries are beginning to fill is what a commercial cherry grower would do because their livelihood depends on being able to sell cherries that don't have larvae in them. And our all-purpose fruit sprays are an okay choice for that. But it's a timing issue to spray after the petals fall off, but before the cherries start to ripen. And that's a short window of opportunity for treating to control the fly before she lays her eggs in the fruit.
All right, let's go back to the phone. Suzanne is on the line in Clive. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, good morning.
What's your question?
My question is, I have fine-line buckthorn bushes, and we've had them probably 5 or 6 years, never had any issue until last year. We had Japanese beetles. This year, we have Japanese beetles, and they're just dripping them. So my question is there anything we can do for these Japanese beetles? We put bare tree and shrub, I think my husband said it was, systemically on our fine line buckthorns.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also out there a couple times a day with a bowl with soapy water to pick them off and put them in that. And I just didn't know if there's anything else we can do. And then also, because they're kind of really stripped, is it okay to, they're tall, they're probably 7, 8, 9 feet tall, I've got 5 of them, to take them down a third this fall because they're so stripped?
Cutting them back probably isn't going to make any difference to the Japanese beetles. They will feed on however much you leave, however much is there. The systemic insecticide, if it was done early enough, should have been protecting the plants. Hand picking is a great hobby, and one way to control Japanese beetles is to pick them off, as you've described. Screening would be another possibility, but you have to have a pretty fine mesh screen to keep the Japanese beetles from feeding. So I think you've hit two out of the three possibilities. The only other one is to spray insecticide on the plants. I guess there is a
form. Oh, we did do that, too. I'm sorry. We did. We put seven on them.
Okay.
But that wasn't really effective. But see, we just started doing that in the past week, and we just did the systemic thing in the past week because they've really just gotten bad.
Yeah.
We're probably too late.
Well, the systemic has to go through the roots, up the plant, and out into the leaves. And there's always this argument how long that takes. And some people think it's a week. Some people think it's 3 weeks. Some people think it's instantaneous. So I say it's closer to the 2 to 3 weeks that it's going to take for the insecticide to get out into the foliage to actually protect it. So that treatment needs to come a little earlier. The spray probably killed the ones that are there, just like hand picking kills the ones that are there at the moment. But more keep appearing. As far as cutting them back, would you do that, Richard?
I would not. If you're going to prune it back, I would probably do so in late winter, early spring. But my guess is that's a pretty tough plant, that it's going to leaf out just fine next spring.
Which is the fourth option I was referring to, is that's tolerate the damage. Yes, the plant looks bad. Yes, it's a temporary problem in the appearance of the plant, but it's not fatal. Defoliation is not death for deciduous plants.
All right, Suzanne, thanks a lot for your call. Let's squeeze in a couple more email questions here. Tracy in Mason City, this past winter, the aphids nearly killed my orange tree. Should I repot my orange tree this summer to help minimize the aphid population this coming winter?
Whoa, I don't think repotting is going to make any difference to the aphids when they get on the plant. Soapy water and insecticidal soap would probably be a better choice than that. But repotting is something that you do have to do occasionally. So
right. If it hasn't been repotted in maybe 2 or 3 years, I'd get a slightly bigger pot, and right now would be a good time.
All right, and Jim says, I went out on the deck the other morning and found about 15 June bugs swimming around on the surface of a bucket of water. Should I have let them drown or dump them out somewhere? What do they and their larvae eat?
Well, the June bugs are all adult stages of various white grubs, and when we say June bug, we've narrowed it down to about 30,000 different kinds of beetles that it could be. But the typical June bug comes as a lives as a grub in grass, but it's usually not maintained turf grass. When people say June bug, if they're talking about the mahogany brown ones, they come out of pastures and meadows and other places, but they all come as from grubs.
All right. So should he have dumped them out or let them drown? It's an ethical question.
It's an ethical question. You know, how does karma feel on your soul at the moment?
Donald Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity. Always a pleasure.
Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist. We will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.